The next case, number 25-1824 and number 25-1859, Mario Suarez versus FCA US LLC. At this time, would counsel to the appellant, cross-appellee, please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Yes, my name is Kenneth Bird, and may it please the court, I represent the plaintiff and a class of Massachusetts vehicle owners of 93,000 vehicle owners. And Judge Helpe, I'd request 2 minutes of rebuttal time if that's okay.
Okay. And let me ask a question for both sides, similar to the previous case. I've looked at the Underwood case, and there is an issue about actual knowledge in that particular case. It says it here doesn't even apply. But it recognizes that it may be a possibility. So isn't this a case that perhaps we should certify that to the SJC here in Massachusetts? And I'll hear that from both sides, so I won't, so please go ahead.
Yes, and if you want me to start with that,
please.
I'm happy to do that. Yes, that's something we asked for in our brief. I think that you can certify this to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court.
And it would be dispositive if this is ruled right. One way or another. It's if there's just actual knowledge, then that's the end of the case. We don't even have to go into the other issues.
I believe that that's correct, and you have to, there are some other issues. There are some other reversible issues, I guess, to deal with that we raise, which are not the primary point. The main point is the knowledge issue, as you say, and it could go to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and especially in a case.
There's a jury instruction.
Correct.
By actual knowledge. So if it's resolved and it's reversed because the SJC would tell us it's got to be this way, then it's a new trial.
Correct. It definitely would be.
So it'd be issues that would have to be redisposed of in the new trial.
Right. And let's just jump into Underwood for just a second, because it would be important to do that, especially since the opposing party here is seeking to take Underwood and basically get rid of Slaney, get rid of V-Mark, get rid of the underlying FTC rulings that all talk about a should have known standard. And so everything really comes down to this analysis of this one case, Underwood. And just to talk about it for a second, in Underwood, it's an entirely different issue. You have one person, a landlord, not a large company, not a company with thousands of employees. You have one landlord in a landlord-tenant dispute where the contract where the tenant was not supposed to have any children in the tenancy and by contract. And the appeals court looks at the willful and knowing treble damages finding. That's really what the Supreme Court of Massachusetts was looking at, was the willful and knowing finding, and says that the lower court just found sort of knowledge based on a suspicion, because this person, this landlord, was in the real estate business, was in the, knew that lead paint was harmful and knew that old houses had lead paint in it. That was it. There were no, yeah.
Let me just ask you about that reading of the case, because when I read it, I did read it differently than the way you just presented it, because after the introduction, which does talk about the willful standard, as you said, the court goes on to say, we must determine, therefore, whether any such duty exists under 93A. A duty exists under 93A to disclose material facts known to a party at the time of a transaction. There is no liability for failing to disclose what a person does not know. So that's just a clear statement of law about what duty 93A imposes, and specifically when the claim is a failure to disclose or an omission claim. So I guess I read the case to be quite clear, cutting against your argument, and I'm just want to give you a chance to respond to that, and sort of especially keeping in mind that what the district court here did was to give the model jury instruction on the issue, which is created by various folks working
right
very closely with this particular legal standard in Massachusetts.
Well, a couple different issues there. The MCLE instruction that you're talking about, I can talk about separately, but just on the Underwood case itself, the first of all, the question I believe is knowledge. When they talked about that, you have to have knowledge. You have to understand that In Slaney originally, that they also, they look at that case, but they don't talk about it. Slaney talks about an engine defect case, just like this. It passes a motion to dismiss to say that when you omit a material fact about an engine defect, okay, that you should have known about, that is actionable under Section 9. So that's an omission case that says it's actionable.
I understand, but even if we agreed with you about Slaney, Underwood obviously comes later. It's a decision of the SJC. We can't, sitting in diversity, not apply the latest precedent of the SJC on a question of Massachusetts law. So if we could just focus on Underwood,
sure.
How does Underwood not stand for the proposition that I just read to you, which just talks about what is the duty that 93A imposes in an admission, for an admission claim based on failure to disclose? And it seems to say quite clearly you have to actually know what you're failing to disclose.
Well, understood. But it doesn't say anything in that case about the standard is subjective, like the court in our trial said. And it also, you know, imagine if the facts in Underwood were, I mean, the facts are very different. The court goes on to suggest that there's no other evidence, so it's inapplicable. The court goes on to say that, you know, it has been suggested that you can do kind of a should have known standard. It has been, they mentioned that later in the case. It has been suggested that you can prove knowledge by what you should know. And they say that's inapplicable here because you don't have any evidence of that. So imagine if in Underwood, the landlord had several rental facilities in the same place, had numerous complaints about lead-based poisoning, had numerous tests done that were sent to that landlord, had been warned several times by people who know about it that there's lead-based paint there, and had received numerous complaints and just ignored it. And then omitted that information. I think the Massachusetts Supreme Court would see that very differently. They just saw literally none of that. And so the question is, you know, omissions do not have some higher scienter knowledge requirement under the statute. The statute says nothing about a subjective test. I mean, what the judge read to the jury was in the instruction, the district court here, in determining whether the class has proved that FCA failed to disclose a material fact, you must examine what FCA knew, not what a reasonable person or company would have known. The test is a subjective one. And
that's because, I mean, another sentence from Underwood that doesn't help you is knowing requires more than negligence. So negligence is what would the reasonable person have known, and did you meet the standard? And so what that's saying is negligence is not enough. You can't look broadly. You have to look at this individual person. So, I mean, your test should have known. Isn't that like a classic negligence formulation?
No, because because 93A establishes the duty. It's not a regular negligence issue because 93A establishes the duty. And the 93A case law through...
How does the idea, the concept of should have known vary from traditional understandings of negligence?
Because the should have known standard is in, well, the 93A case law is very clear that it goes beyond regular tort claims. It protects broader than regular tort claims and broader than common law fraudulent deceit.
It says liability, which is knowing, requires more than negligence. And I guess I'm asking you then, what you read to me as what the judge gave as the instruction sounds to me like a negligence instruction. And so if it is a negligence instruction and you map it onto 93A, what Underwood says is that's not right. It has to be knowing as to you, defendant, not reasonably understood as to the community that you didn't act with due care, and should have known seems to be driving at that idea.
Understood, and that's a point well taken, but 93A itself, the statute, has none of this language about that it's a subjective standard. And Underwood, if it's truly changing the law, I mean, maybe we're back to certifying this, because if it's truly Slaney is also a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court case that says it is actionable to omit an engine defect if you should have known about it. VMark is a case after, it's an appeals court case, not a Massachusetts Supreme Court case. V-Mark is another instructive case, I think, to look at. And in that case, just briefly, that also involves omissions. There's representations, but there's also omissions. And it says, when it looks at what the trial judge did below in V-Mark, this was sort of computer software that was alleging how great the software could work and it didn't work. And the appeals court goes through what the trial judge actually found line by, you know, in the underlying trial. And it says that V-Mark knew, and it puts in parentheticals, or should have known, the following things, and said that. In parentheticals, and then talks about the fact that there's not willful and knowing enough here to have to treble damages, but there is, and the court says, and I urge you to look at it, sufficient awareness. A sufficient awareness, and that's in the case law, certainly starts looking like a should have known standard. And that's with omissions as well. And you have...
Going back to Judge Aframe's question, you're not talking about mere negligence. This would be maybe more recklessness or a higher standard. But it's definitely not the actual knowledge itself. It's maybe like, are you saying it's like an in-between standard? Or?
Well, I'm saying that for the baseline liability on a 93A claim, that the standard is, that you have to... that. There is no discussion about knowledge in the statute. There is just, do you commit a deceptive act? Omission is one avenue and a mode of a deception. And it doesn't talk about knowledge, but the cases have said if you have a sufficient awareness. And
if we put in criminal terms, you need to have some sort of mens rea to do it, to commit a 93A act.
You have to know or should have known or have the or be susceptible to actual knowledge. There's other cases. The First Circuit looked at this, I believe, in Nichols, where they talk about, is it susceptible of actual knowledge? And so we see all these cases. So
it means to me, at least, maybe I'm using my old prosecutor's frame, but yeah. One is you knew, one is you were willfully blind to it, which substitutes for actual knowledge because the facts were right in front of you and you closed your eyes to them. And the third is you were asleep at the switch. There were facts swirling around and you didn't sort of intentionally blind yourself to them, but you missed them. And is your argument that all three of those ideas are actionable?
They can be under 93A. And I would argue that to suggest otherwise, to do what under... To read Underwood the way FCA is reading it would mean that the Massachusetts legislature has intended that, you know, to encourage would encourage businesses to just keep their head in the sand and never know anything.
That's not the instruction you asked for. I guess that's what's bothers. I mean, that's should have known isn't, to me at least, willful blindness. Willful blindness is in the face of basically blinking red lights, you closed your eyes to them and went ahead and did what you wanted to do and should have known is lesser than that.
We didn't ask directly for willful blindness. What we asked for was on the docket 287-2, what we requested was that in determining whether Chrysler failed to disclose a material fact to consumers at the time of the transaction, you must determine whether Chrysler knew or had reasonable grounds for knowing about the material fact at the time of the transaction. Like any other fact, you may infer Chrysler had knowledge of the material fact through circumstantial evidence. That's what we asked for. And that's essentially a should have known standard. And, you know, the 93A was not meant by the Massachusetts legislature to let, you know, we're not talking about one landlord here looking into the subjective mind of one landlord. We're talking about that is now being translated to a large company and saying, well, how do you look into the mind of Chrysler and find their subjective intent? If that's going to happen, we need to. Can I just
go ahead?
If that's going to happen, I think that we do need to go back and certify the question because we don't want a situation where people can just set up a separate entity to do all the testing, all the red flags that would come in through complaints, to have all the negative news that might come in and just say, we never want to hear about it. That entity never shared that information with our decision makers. And then we just subjectively don't know. I'm happy to address the other questions on my rebuttal.
Okay. Let's hear from...
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee Cross appellant, please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Brandon Boxer on behalf of Appellee FCA. Underwood answers the question. It is the most recent and most on-point decision from the SJC describing the Sienter standard required for an emission-based 1983A claim. And it said, quote, to recover under Chapter 93A for non-disclosure, plaintiff must show defendant knew the allegedly concealed fact. Just a couple months ago in the Lester case, which was the subject of one of our 28J letters, the Massachusetts Appeals Court reiterated that the duty to disclose under 93A extends only to material facts known to a party. Sheehy, which was another appeals court decision, actually issued before Underwood, studied the case law on this issue in Massachusetts and said, look, the case law, quote, affirms the obvious principle that someone should not be liable for not disclosing what he does not know. This court in Gooley.
Do you account, just to respond to that argument, account for Slaney?
Yeah, a couple things on Slaney. One, that the Sienter question of this known, should I have known, wasn't squarely presented in that case. It did look at the allegation that the allegation was that the defendant knew or should have known. And the court said, well, that could be good enough under 12b-6, but it didn't take which side of the disjunctive could have been sufficient, right? And then if there's any doubt about Slaney, look at Underwood, because Underwood cites Slaney, and it says we have never held that should have known or negligence is enough. And so the SJC, looking at its own case law, which includes Slaney, says that's not what we said in Slaney. Here's the standard. It's a knowledge-based standard.
But Underwood also says, you say it's correct, but then it says it has been suggested that actual knowledge may not be required if such knowledge can be inferred from receipt of a complaint which requires an investigation of the facts. And it goes farther from any of the cited cases and applicable here in this particular case. So doesn't that leave at least a small window open?
No, Your Honor. And I think, Judge Helpe, I think it's the language in that the next sentence after you quoted where it says, even this suggestion goes further than any of our decided cases. So if there's anything to sort of read from those tea leaves, it's that suggestion is too far, that you can't just infer knowledge from a complaint. And so I think, you know, Underwood and Sheehy and...
You know, did this case end up here in the federal court by removal or by original diversity?
It was CAFA jurisdiction, the Class Action Fairness Act, which is a form of diversity. So that was originally.
How does that work? Is it originally filed in state court and brought here by you, or they file it in federal court?
They originally filed in federal court under CAFA. So I don't think there's any reason to certify the question. I mean, the Underwood answers the question, and the standard that this court uses to determine whether to certify is it reasonably clear what the answer would be? And I think Underwood makes it crystal clear. It's not just reasonably clear. There's no case that has imposed liability under the should have known standard that plaintiffs are pursuing and asking this court, sitting in diversity, reviewing a decision that happened after a jury verdict, to sort of suggest that there's a change in Massachusetts law. I think the court should reject that invitation. I also want to address the question. I think it was Judge Aframe, you asked, would it be dispositive? Is this question dispositive? It was Judge Helpe. And I think the answer is no, because we do have those alternative grounds for affirmance. And so the court, if it has doubts about it, could look at the Iannaccino arguments, could look at the other arguments that we made for alternative grounds for affirmance. So it's not necessarily dispositive, this question, although we think it's pretty clear under Underwood. There was a suggestion by my friend on the other side that Underwood changed the law. And for the reasons that we've already discussed, there was no change. I mean, so far as there's a suggestion that there was a change from Slaney to Underwood, Underwood itself, by not only citing Slaney, but also saying we looked at all the cited cases, and they do not support this negligence standard that plaintiffs here are suggesting. The VMARC case was brought up by my friend on the other side, saying that support is should have known standard. If you actually look at that case, the language that my friend cited,
what year is that case, counsel?
I believe it was 1994.
1994, so it's a year after Underwood?
Correct. And the language that my friend cited, it says, VMARC knew or should have known when it made the unqualified representations to EMC regarding the capabilities that the software still had defects. So in that context, they're discussing affirmative misrepresentations that the defendant made, not a pure omission. And as we explained in our briefs, the law is very clear that there's a distinction between an omission-based claim and a misrepresentation or a false advertising-based claim. I mean, that's very well settled. I mean, Underwood recognizes it. This court in Tomasella has pages kind of discussing the difference and cites to FTC Act cases describing the difference. So it's very well settled. The other thing I want to just address briefly is the willful blindness suggestion or argument that counsel made. I'd say a couple things on willful blindness. First of all, the theory was not pursued below. Indeed, it came up during one of the pretrial conferences, and this is a transcript docket 299, where the judge said that they could pursue this theory at trial if they wanted to, subject to FTC's ability to object, and they didn't pursue it. They didn't propose a jury instruction on it. They didn't. The terms willful blindness, if you search the trial transcript, never once came up. It was not a theory they pursued. And as we explained, I think Judge Aframe, you recognized, willful blindness could be a way of proving actual knowledge. And that's the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Unicolors, which recognized that. So insofar as there's policy concerns about corporations burying their head in the sand, of course, those should be arguments that we've made to the Massachusetts courts to change the law. But insofar as those are policy concerns at issue, they are covered by the Underwood standard, the actual knowledge standard per that Unicolors decision.
Counsel, can I ask you just to go back to Underwood versus Slaney? There is language in Slaney that suggests that the allegations about the engine defect, which was an omission, potentially could proceed. So I'm just wondering how you read that case. It seems that at the end, what the actual ruling that the SJC hands down is that they're sustaining the interlocutory demur based on minority, and they're just sending it all back for a fresh take in light of 93A. So is that how you read the case as well?
Exactly right, Judge Ruckelman. That's how we read it.
And so is your view just that whatever language they had about what the engine defect claim could have been or could not have been as an omission claim isn't really central to the holding? And therefore, that's why we should really focus on Underwood, or would you put it differently? Because there's no, I mean, opposing counsel is absolutely right that Slaney has a discussion at page 702 to 703 about the claims around the engine defect and suggesting that they could perhaps go forward.
Yeah, I would say a couple things about Slaney. So Slaney, I think, is the opinion states in one of the opening paragraphs that it was the SJC's first opportunity to kind of speak to the substance and procedure of the statute. So I think the decision does cover a wide basis. And it resolved the demur issue by saying there is a breach of warranty claim and that's good enough. But furthermore, we're going to consider these other issues. And the other issues, it did include those discussions that Judge Ruckelman, you're pointing to. But in that discussion, there was no discussion of the actual scienter standard, which was pled in the alternative. So the court simply didn't resolve that issue. It didn't need to resolve the issue because it was already going to send it back. And I think Your Honor was pointing to the conclusion where the panel or the court says, go back, they can replead this, take into account everything that we've explained in this decision about the statute, let them try again in an amended complaint, and that's all they did. And again, to the extent there's any question about if the holding was broader than that, Underwood answers that by saying we've never gone so far as plaintiffs here are suggesting they did in construing their own precedent.
But basically, you think Slaney didn't really speak to the issue?
That's correct. It didn't need to, and it didn't. That's correct.
Counsel, if you could address the issue about the juror who was allegedly biased on, or apparently said he was biased or had a conflict on the sixth day of trial and he was not excused till the end of trial, you could address that.
Sure, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, it's an abuse of discretion review. You know, Judge Burroughs was there for all this. And she did not find that there was actual bias. She reiterated that in her order denying the motion for new trials, finding I did not find that he had to be excused for cause. I dismissed this juror in abundance of caution. And so the suggestion by my friends on the other.
What you're saying is that her finding of there's no actual bias, that does it all, whether she had excused him on the sixth day or the seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, or whatever it was, it's still, there's no cause and effect.
That's another reason. And the juror was dismissed before there were deliberations. And so there's...
And I am aware she gave the typical instructions, don't discuss the case with anybody. And again, there's no contention that that ever happened or request to pull that juror or whatever. But my question is, the fact that she made that finding of not actual, you know, there's no grounds to her disqualifying, there's no actual bias, that does it, technically.
I don't think, well, yes, that does it. You can kind of stop there. But if this court sitting in review finds that that was an abuse of discretion, then still the juror was dismissed, this supposedly biased juror that should...
Before the deliberations, and she took all the precautions.
Exactly right, Judge Helby. And I do want to just kind of pick up on the point that you brought about the instructions. I mean, and Judge Burroughs put this, I think, in footnote 5 of her order denying the motion for new trial. She told all the jurors on the first day of trial, don't discuss this case until the deliberations. If you look at the trial transcripts at the end of every single day, Judge Burroughs reminds all the jurors, don't discuss this case until you start deliberations. In her discussions with the juror number 9.
That's the footnote you said. And she also says, as most trial judges do, she repeated it every single day.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And so I think, you know, there's a very strong presumption that jurors follow their instructions. There's no evidence here that the jurors followed their instructions. There's no evidence here that this allegedly biased juror participated in the deliberations, impacted the deliberations. So it's just entirely speculative. And I'm not aware of any case, and my friends on the other side have not cited any case where a court has found that it's reversible error to...
It's, again, I'm not aware of any case that would say that's a structural error you're entitled to in the trial.
Exactly right, Judge Helby.
Other than just back to Slaney, just because I'm focusing on some of this language now, I understand you can just say Underwood is later and it's the rule, but it is a failure to disclose case. They do say specifically you don't need to prove common law fraud. They set out the elements of common law fraud. Then they say you don't need to show reliance. That's one point. And then they say, and it's not necessary to establish that the defendant knew the representation was false. What do they mean by that? That accords with Underwood. What brings them together?
I think the key language in that sentence, Judge Aframe, is that don't have to establish that the defendant knew the representation was false.
And yet,
that's an affirmative.
It may be a poorly structured opinion, but they're clear. They're talking about an omission at the top of this discussion.
Correct.
They know they're talking about an omission, and then they say that. So was that like, what are they trying to say?
I think they're providing a discussion about Chapter 93A more broadly, which is that it is not limited to common law torts. It's a sui generis statute. It's a new cause of action. And I believe my friends on the other side cited the Igniti case, which is a recent decision, which actually held it was reversible error on that basis. The trial judge instructed the jurors that in order to find 93A liability, you had to find on a common law tort, and that was reversible error. And I think that's the discussion of Slaney there, which is saying, look, it's a sui generis statute. It's not limited to fraud. It's not limited to sort of these traditional tort concepts. Liability can be broader than that, including in Slaney, right, which was a breach of warranty case. So that could have been a viable.
And it's pled in the alternative, so I don't know how you're supposed to deal with that either.
Okay. Exactly right, Judge Aframe. And I would say just to, again, go back to Underwood, it confirms this reading. It cites Underwood, cites Slaney for this discussion about how that 93A is not limited to traditional tort concepts like fraud and misrepresentation claims. So I think that the SJC is kind of clarifying, confirming our reading of it in Underwood and not the way that my friends on the other side do. If there's nothing further, we appreciate the court's time and ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you very much.
2 minutes rebuttal. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Kenneth Bird again for the plaintiff and the class of vehicle owners. At best, FCA has shown you a conflict between two Massachusetts Supreme Court cases that would then need to be certified. To be clear, On the Underwood case, when the court does look at Slaney later in the case, but in the section that it looks at, when it says that the analysis of sort of red flags to suggest otherwise is further than we have ever gone or something, it says, but that's inapplicable here. And I don't believe the Underwood case is really taking the time to look at what a baseline violation looks like, because they're again, they began the analysis with looking at the trebling of damages, then they just get rid of the whole thing, but there's not a talk about it. The court also needs to look.
You also say your scenario is different. This is a huge corporation versus one landlord.
Correct. And I would urge the court, yes, we don't have other Supreme Judicial Court cases, but please look at VMARC, which is in 94 after Underwood, that talks about omissions, among representations, but also omissions, and talks about new or should have known. And we can't just get rid of that. Look at Agniti versus Philip Morris, USA, here in 2026 in the Massachusetts Appeals Court. Again, it's not the Supreme Court, but certainly persuasive about how 93A claims are actually operating on the ground in Massachusetts. In Philip Morris, where they say Chapter 93A does not require proof that the defendant knew the representation was in false and intended to deceive the plaintiff. Same type of language. There is no case anywhere that says omissions are given some sort of different standard of review. And then I would also point the court to Damon versus Sun. It's a First Circuit case. 87 F3rd.
A different sort of review. I mean, it strikes me that a representation you are taking on, I'm telling you this, and so the implication of that is it is so. When I don't say anything about something, that seems to make the Underwood idea make sense, that you may be negligent to not know something, but you didn't take that next step to affirmatively assert it as so.
The problem is that 93A makes it very clear in Section 2. It doesn't give much guidance. It doesn't go into all this, but it says deceptive practices and unfair practices are unlawful. And then it says the only guidance it gives is go look at FTC decisions, and we want you to follow that. And there's no different standard or scienter standard in omissions. There's just not. And the First Circuit has repeated that in FTC case after FTC case that we cite to. So I think this court can look at Slaney and VMARC and Agniti and FTC versus Direct Marketing Company, which is a First Circuit opinion from 2010, where they talk about a deceptive advertising campaign, where the corporate officer knew or should have known that there was no reasonable basis for the deceptive claims. It was an FTC violation. And they can do that and realize that Underwood is being sort of overly read here and overly used. But if not, it does need to go to the Massachusetts Supreme Court, Judicial Court, before we sort of undo 93A claims and people wake up to a subjective standard for even the baseline violation.
Thank you. That concludes argument in this case.